Well, to pick that up, as I say, I was very happy with going back to the old firm, slightly embarrassed, but happy. And then I remember very well those intervening weeks between getting my job back, giving my notice in, and expecting it to take a month, work out the month. And suddenly I started to realize that I liked jobbing. I started to, I mean, the first impressions were horrid and I hated it. But 2 or 3 weeks later, I was starting to like it, and I thought, well, I've been a BF, you know. And I remember very well going home and actually crying to my mother and saying, what a damn fool I've been. And I really was in a state, and I said to my mother, you know, I really have made a mess of things, and, you know, it's not the sort of thing you can undo. Anyhow, having run around the city and got this job back and done so and so forth, I then walked up to Harry Bishop one day in the house and plucked up enough courage and said, excuse me, sir, can I speak to you? I'd like to do it. And he said, what are you talking about, boy? You're not allowed to speak to me here. See me in the office this evening. And he just admonished me. He said, no, you're not allowed to speak to me. So I plucked up enough courage in the evening, and I knocked on the door, and he said, what is it? You know, and I walked in, and they never knew me and never recognized me and so on. And I told him of my misgivings and my upsets and that, and he said, I haven't any time to listen to this thing. Where was that? Anyhow, come the end of my month, he called me in and he said, Winterflood, you've been a damn fool. We don't mind giving you a second chance, but we'd never want you to behave like this again. And I was so grateful, I can't tell you, because it would have been the end of my life, I felt at the time. And I was so grateful. I think I could have gone and sort of kissed his boots or something. Anyhow, I said, well, I can't, you know, I'm very appreciative of it. It's marvellous. Thank you very much. I do want to stay on and like the job. So, and I remember yet again getting out of that office and running like a madman back to Greenness to say, look, I'm awfully sorry, but I really can't come. And I remember, it's just funny how the sort of the feeling of perspiration, of it being absolutely worn out, of being out of breath, that's the sort of thing you can remember. And I went to see a chap called Sexton, who was, if you like, out of the partners, he was probably the mildest. And I put my case, and he very kindly agreed to see the senior partner. Because I thought what would happen is I'd get it, and then they'd refuse to deal with this company because I'd muck them up. Anyhow, it all got resolved, and I stayed, and I'm glad to say was happy ever after. It didn't alter the fact that I was still working under Harold Taylor. And he really was, he never got better. I mean, he was always bad. And what would happen was that you'd do all the work, and he'd expect you to do things, and you'd do it. And I mean, things like getting the paper for his racing and making sure you sent notes to his bookie, and I mean, apart from business. And as things progressed, you didn't really think about too much about being authorized. I mean, it was a big jump. It's not like today where they expect to be authorized in 5 minutes. You were scared to be authorized. At least I was scared. I mean, and it was a big, big thing to be authorized. To be able to deal, to have that authority was really something. I can't tell you the sort of feeling about it. And the fear of actually getting it was just as you know, just as extraordinary, really. Anyhow, came the day that I did get authorized. And what you had to do when you were put up for authorization, you'd have to go upstairs to the committee, and all sorts of things had to be sorted out. But the big fear of blokes like myself was that you had to understand Rule 90, just a big peculiar rule for them. And or was it Rule 85? Well, anyway, there was a specific rule, and it was about your responsibilities and duties and so on. And we all learned it by heart, you see. And you never knew whether you were going to be asked or not. They always asked somebody who knows you. And there was the character backgrounds that people had to know and so on. Anyhow, we did all that, and the next day, once they'd posted it, you then were given your badge and you were allowed to deal on behalf of that firm, and you swapped your blue badge for a black badge and so on. And I don't usually use expletives and things like this, but I mean, to tell you how evil this man was. I came onto the floor that morning, and I'd been round to the various boxes, and he was already on the pitch. And he walked up to me and he said, well, and he had his hand like this, sort of held into his body, and he looked at me and he thrust his hand out and he said, "Yeah, Winterflood, mind your effing eye." And that's all he said. And you know, you thought, my God, I've just reached the pinnacle of my career, you know, and this man said this, and he put the fear of God into me, you know. I mean, you didn't want to pick up a book, you didn't want to deal, you didn't want to do anything. And so he sort of knocked the wind out of my sails a bit. It took a little while to get into the swing of things. And I remember once you got in the swing of things, I felt that I did have a sort of natural grasp of the thing. But he would come back from lunch where I would be looking after the book. And what he would do, he would come back. If he had a good day, he wasn't too bad. In other words, if he won on the horses. If he had a bad day, or been to the club and somebody upset him, he'd come back and he would look. He'd sit on the bench and he'd look through all the jobbing book pages. And he'd look at, say, I don't know, whatever we were dealing. Let's say it was Elswick Hopper. And he'd look at the bogus and say, "Fuck." And he goes through it. All he kept grunting was effing this, effing that, you know. And I remember on one particular day, I thought, I'd done such a fantastic bargain. I've made a lot of money on this bargain. And I was waiting for him to get to this bargain. And he was, you know, and all nasty. And it got up to him, and I thought, this is going to be really my day. And he went, didn't grunt, didn't do anything. Went past it.
Turned the page.
Yeah. Hmm. So I couldn't sort of contain myself. I said, "Excuse me, sir, but... did you see, sir?" So he said, "It only pays for the bad ones." I thought, God, this is, I don't know if I'm going to survive this, you know. And it never seemed to get, and though he wasn't a terribly nasty man, I mean, he didn't sort of hold grudges, just his attitude. And I thought, well, I really can't go on this. I'll go bonkers in the end. And then finally there was a change round and I was taken off his book and put on Jimmy Bisgood's. And it was like, I mean, I can't tell you, it was like going from hell to heaven. And Jimmy was such a nice man, and is such a nice man. And Jimmy allowed me to get on with it and encouraged me and sort of, he was a father figure. He was my champion, really. I mean, people have champions, and certainly Jimmy was my champion. He had another dealer on the book at the time, who was more senior than I was, but very nice, very understanding. And Superman. Really a Superman.
Which book had Howard Taylor been running?
We were running things like the, not rubber stocks in the sense of the commodity, but we were running things like RubberX and BTRs, general industrials really, and a sort of a mixture of things, whereas with Jimmy, we were on the motor book, very definitely a sector. But Howard's was a mixture of things. It was components, it was industrials, not General Doll's Body, but fairly leading stocks, all well-known names. And then next to him were the Bishops, and they had very unmarketable stocks, you know, I suppose in lots of ways, the odds and sods, much more negotiation, whereas Howard's were reasonably liquid and there was always a two-way price and so on. And Jimmy's were very liquid, and we had things like BMC, which was a gigantic stock at the time. We dealt in Roots and things like that. And I mean, it was a lovely job then, and I enjoyed every day, and I enjoyed coming up, yes. And I didn't mind staying, and it was lovely.
You said three of you were running the book.
Well, Tim Bryars was a member. I was the dealer. Tim Bryars was the member, and Jimmy was the direct
partner. Now, how did that work? How did you function together as a unit?
Well, Jimmy was in charge, and he would make prices to people and speak to people generally. And I suppose, in a way, we all did the same job. But if there was a big one, Jimmy would have to be consulted, and he would probably do it. The ordinary run-of-the-mill stuff Tim and I would do, although I would have to refer to Tim. Sort of chain of command was, you know, you refer all the way up. And you didn't take on a big proposition unless Jimmy okayed it. There were lots of odds and ends, small dealers around, and I'd be expected to do the hundreds and 200s. Tim would probably do the bigger bargains, and Jimmy would do the major bargains, and Jimmy would do the negotiations with people. He would look after, if you like, any deals off of the market floor. There were always, it's not dissimilar to what we do now. I mean, I have directors and senior members in charge of books now. And if there's anything outside of the cash allocations we give, they come and refer to me. After all, it is the exposure of the company. So not a lot has changed. And if, what I'm saying really is that what I learned there, I've put in place here. And that has stood us in very good stead throughout the terrific changes that have gone over the last 20 years, 30 years. And so that old style of jobbing and of containing positions serves us well now. Mm.
Did you actually have your own books?
Yes. Mm. All the jobbing, I think on our sector, we must have had a half a dozen books. Mm. We probably dealt in 60 or 70 stocks. And so, I mean, we always had sort of three dealers so that you didn't have to keep people waiting. I mean, trying to provide a service. And Bisgood, you know, we're a very small firm. Mm. And strangely enough, when I was broking, it wasn't one of the firms that I would naturally go to. Mm. Probably because your first impressions are that, oh, he's a likely dad, we'll go there, or this man's friendly or so. Mm. They were a little bit fringe, you know, when I was a broker. Mm. And there were things wrong. I mean, it was probably because Howard Taylor was such a bully. Harry Bishop was a very autocratic senior partner. Ingram Capper's a marvellous man, but there again, he was not the friendliest of men. He would he was very much the hunt and shoot and a fishing type. Mm. And it was all right if he was talking about the guns to his mates. He didn't have a lot of time for young people. In the early days, I have to say that he was probably, apart from Jimmy, the only man that saw the future belong to the young, if you like. And it was when he became senior partner, he really gave us our heads and sort of retired from the day-to-day stuff. So I have a great respect for him. He's passed on now, but I have a great respect for him. But at the time, he was very much a bit cocky, you know, and... he would say things like a chap would come up and just say price and size, and he would might say Rolls Royce are 26 and 9 pence to 27 and 3 pence or something like that, and the chap might say, "Can I deal?" And he'd say, "Yes," and the chap would say, "I'll sell you 250,000." He said, "Yes, you can deal in 20,000. But of course, I was aware. I said, "Oh, you couldn't say that. I mean, if you say yes, you're offering to deal." But he was such a bully that he said, "Well, you did say so." He said, "I'm sorry, you can deal in 25,000. And he'd get away with it. You know, there was a lot of bullying like that. Mm. And of course, he met his match when he did that with the senior partner who made him stick to it, you know. But they were the characters. Mm. You know, they really were the characters. Mm. You have pictures in your mind of the man actually standing out there on this little bench that we had facing the main pitch. He was a giant of a man. He was a huge, tall man, probably magnified now in my eyes, but he was a tall man. He was an aristocratic looking man. He was he was somebody that you thought twice about saying anything out of the ordinary. A lot of the other partners were very insignificant compared to him and to Jimmy and even Howard, even though he was nasty, he was quite a powerful figure. Not a big man, but I suppose because some people are a bit nasty, you have a different regard for them. Some of the others weren't, as I say, they were characters in their own right, but they weren't big. We had a fixed interest book, which was run by a chap called Selly, and what was the other man's name, Sally? And I can't remember his name. Anyhow, these two men had this fixed interest book absolutely tied up. And they lived the life of Riley. I mean, they were away from the main pitch. They didn't have to contend with the same sort of brokers. Mm. It was much more a gentlemanly affair. And they got on with their job. And I must say, I think people generally in the firm were pretty happy, you know. Mm. They were happy because they made a lot of money. Mm. And they were taken, they were self-made men, but they were taken into the partnership. And as usually happened in the stock exchange in those days, for years you were in the red. But you were taken in to create cessations. And actually, I mean, people were taken in, they didn't know what they were getting into. I mean, you were just grateful to get in. I mean, they could have sold you a real pup. Mm. But they'd been going for many, many years, and they had a certain reputation. And you left a lot to trust. You really did, and I did trust these people. Anyhow, I was a junior partner at some later stage, and it was a long time before I actually got in the red, but they still paid you a bonus, albeit small in some years, and reasonably generous in other years. And as I say, the tax structure was strange at the time because they had you in when somebody was going out because of this business of cessation of partnerships, and they clawed back the tax. They made vast amounts of money. And it's when it all happened for me, I made a certain amount of capital as well. Maybe it wasn't big, but it at least put me back into the black and allowed me to be a partner in my own right. I don't know. It's difficult to, you know, you sort of cover the years too quickly when you're recalling things like this. Just trying to think of what happened. I mean, some of the characters of the house that time, there was one chap that used to come in occasionally. We faced the war memorial, and say we were at this end of the house under this biggish dome. There was a bigger dome down the other end. And people used to flick these paper aircraft up and see if they could get them stuck in this gallery. And if you were a bit slack, they would make these sort of darts, and they'd do this, and they'd go like that, and these things would whiz up. Or they'd play football with a paper ball, or they'd light people's papers, and lots of those things went on. But this particular thing impressed me more than anything was this old man that would occasionally come into the gilt market, and the whole house would sing Jerusalem. And it was a most magnificent sound. I mean, it sort of brought tears to your eyes, really. I mean, it was unbelievable. And I don't think I've ever been impressed with anything more than that, you know. They just all broke into song whenever he came there.
Have you got any idea why that was the case?
No, I don't. Jimmy would know. I'm sure Jimmy would know. I mean, obviously, there was a reason.
Yes.
But it was incredible. The business stopped, you know. They just all sang to this man. It was quite extraordinary.
You've described the partners in Biscuit at more or less the time you joined. How would you describe Biscuit Bishop as a firm when you joined?
Well, as I say, they were fringe in my reckoning of people when I was a broker. I didn't regard them a great deal, as I say, because of those various characters. But yes, it was because they didn't treat juniors, blue buttons, they didn't treat them very well, they didn't have time for them, whereas other brokers, rather other jobbers, did. And it's another lesson, I suppose, that I took to Biscuit when I joined them, was that, you know, tomorrow's or today's blue buttons are tomorrow's dealers, and let's get on the right track with them. And I think it was because they were, in the main, a lot older. There weren't too many young people at Biscuits. And actually, although they dealt in various industrials, lots of industrials and aircraft and motors, they didn't cover other markets. They were a little separate firm that dealt in smaller companies, rather what we're doing now. But other firms would have, I mean, firms like Blackwell would have a textile pitch, they'd have an oil pitch, they'd probably have a mining pitch. Lots of firms had lots of pitches in different industries, and it was easier, of course, as a blue button to go to one firm that covered a lot of things. You would go to Biscuit either because one particular chap was good in the market, or they dealt in out of the way things. So they were rather fringe.
How did they compare in size with other firms?
They were small. In fact, I think there were a lot more jobbers then, but in the final analysis, Biscuit, prior to deregulation, finished up the smallest of the five main jobbers. Lots and lots of jobbers went out before them. Much bigger firms than them, I hasten to add. But we did have a reasonable business in motors. We did have some good Contango business. We had a good solid background of business. We were never going to set the world on fire. We weren't ever going to make the really big money, but it was good, steady progress. As I say, the things that motivated people then were that they were all pretty wealthy in their own right, having built up their positions. But the people like Harry was an extremely wealthy man. Ingram was, they had personal wealth. Jimmy Bisgood, the Bisgood family, a wealthy family. Dickie Bisgood was a partner as well. Howard Taylor, vast amounts of money he'd made over the years. And so they had a nice lifestyle anyway. They weren't out to build empires, I don't think. They were just there to enjoy it. I never remember them really taking any huge strategic decisions to make their company big. In fact, the only real big thing that happened, and rather it's rather blowing my own trumpet, I think, was that the only grow on, the only add on that we had was the USM market.
Well, we'll come to that at a later point. Could you explain what the Contango business was?
Yes, it was a form of carrying over stock. What you do now is if you want to run a stock over an account, you pay a premium to the market maker for the privilege of not paying for that stock. So come the end of the account, if you've got 500 Rolls Royce running and say they were £5 to go, you would sell them to the jobber and buy them back for new time. You didn't actually take them up in your name, you didn't pay stamp, and you had the right to pay for the next account. You paid a rate. You did the same thing with the Contango, but you did it by the jobber taking on the responsibility for that stock and looking after it for you. And it's the same sort of thing, it just rolled over the accounts all the time. And Vic Pagram was our Contango man. Didn't he not go over that with you?
Yes, he did, but it's nice to get a version of different people.
Yeah, it was a form of carrying over business, and it became too expensive in the end, and so it just faded away, really. But Vic was the man that took care of Contangos. He made quite a lot of money for us out of it, but as I say, it just got too expensive in the end. People couldn't afford to use it, and so that's why Cash & New came in. Cash & New was always about, but that was dearer than the other one at one stage, and so on. But there were various Contango firms that did Contangos, but I just remember that Vic did ours, and he sort of looked after everything, and I suppose we knew he was making a good job of it, so we didn't take too much interest in it, really.
Mm-hmm. What were the firm's offices like at the time that you joined? Were they fairly small?
Yes, I joined them when they were in Pinner's Hall, and it was at the far end of Pinner's Hall. It was a bit of a dark building, and I remember the day I got there, I walked in, I was a bit cocky, and I remember this girl, Reenie, was on the telephone. In fact, Reenie only sort of retired, I think, a couple of years ago, and I think she thought I was a bit brash at the time, because I sort of bounced in and said, oh, I'm the new boy, and so on and so forth. And I think they're a bit more subdued than that, you know. And it was a sort of open plan, with Harry Bishop's office being the best one, with the glass, frosted glass windows and a frosted glass door. And you didn't, unless you had very good reason, you didn't go and trouble him. And he sat there behind his great desk. Most of the other stuff was open plan. I think Vic Pagram had an office because he was a partner and the manager. And Ernie Coombs, who was our stats department man, he was a rather important character. I mean, far inflated as a character to the importance he was, really, but he'd sort of made himself important. And he had a stats department, which was a very small office with a junior. A lot of the other things were open plan. Of course, there was a lot of space up there for us to go to with banks at telephones, not dissimilar to this in the evenings when we came from the floor of the house. But it was a dull, slightly dingy office, I always felt, with the old-fashioned switchboard as you came in, and like something in one of the Bolton Brothers films, you know. There was nothing that I remember particularly enthralling about it, you know.
Was there much in the way of office equipment?
No, in fact, you think back, and there was the old, you know, these sort of, what did you call, comptometers. Yes, a few of those about, but I remember very well people using slide rules, you know, quite extraordinary. And of course, everything was manual. I mean, we had these green sheets to agree our positions. I mean, we dealt in hundreds of stocks, and so it was my responsibility the evening to get all the bargains out of the book, which he wrote longhand, and then they had to go out and be typed, you know, put through and agreed and sent down to the stock exchange or something. And then we had these green slips where you would have your bull and bear and you work out your profit and loss and you work out your exposures and so on. But the real killer was to agree those positions. And so you added up the bought and you added up the sold and you came to a position that had to agree with the master. And at the end of the account, to agree the jobbing books to the accounts in the office, I mean, some of the stocks might have been out 500 shares through a checking query or through a mistake or whatever. And Dickie Bisgood, I always remember Dickie. Dickie was the world's worst. Some people would say, oh God, you know, this thing's been out for 3 months or 2 weeks, 252 shares. And they say, well, we write that off. Nothing dishonest about it, but if it came up again, they would take it back in. But they would actually write it off and say, you know, we'll lose that. Dickie was a stickler. We would stay sometimes till 10 o'clock at night to find 85 shares, and we go back through all these lemon lists of we had machines that punched them. I mean, but our computers at those times were rooms like this, you know, full of gear, they typed out these lists, and we would check off hundreds and hundreds of bargains, all for nothing virtually. But he was so meticulous, it was just a nightmare, frankly. And so that rather got us down, and we knew our positions, we knew what we'd made, but he was a stickler for getting it really right to the last penny. At the end of the year, if these things went into the errors account, the firm would have to pay for those errors. But so long as the clients and the brokers didn't suffer, it didn't matter too much. I mean, but it was account to error, and as I say, most people were sensible about it, but Dickie never was. And he did create a heartache for me at times doing those things. But he was a very nice chap, don't get me wrong. He was a very nice man. I liked him enormously. And even now, I mean, one season he went off to Ireland, but he's been up here 3 times. I missed him every time. And I went to Ireland, I missed him out there as well. Quite extraordinary.
Thinking about this time when you were still a dealer, you hadn't become a member. What could you say about the jobbing system in general terms? Were there many jobbers? Was there a league table of jobbers?
Well, yes, certainly there was a league table. I mean, the big boys were Wed de Lacquer. And strangely enough, my early recollections of the stock market didn't involve, although it was probably the most important, the gilt market. We had very little to do with the gilt market. They were very powerful people, the gilt dealers. But they were sort of... it wasn't our business, you know. It was the bank's business. It was the big institution's business. It was the business. And so we didn't have a lot to do with them. But the big names were Francis and Praed at that time. They've gone, actually. But the other big ones were, as I say, it was Aykroyd. It was Atkin. It was Wed de Lacquer. It was C.D. Clark, a big firm. C.D. Clark was quite interesting. C.D. Clark used to lie. They were along one wall of the stock exchange, and every morning two waiters would go to the Threadneedle Street entrance and they would pick up this paraplegic who was one of the senior partners, one of the Clark brothers, and they would put him in this seat, a sort of sedan chair, open sedan chair, and they would march in with this guy in this sort of sedan chair and plonk him on his pitch, because he was paraplegic, things all over his legs, and he would sit there all day. And he was a nasty man. He was a really nasty man. Probably because he was a cripple and so on. But he was a nasty man. And one of the tragic stories about that was a fellow called Keith Knowles. And I suppose he was a mate of mine, although he was a greater mate of mine in later years. But I knew him as a blue button. He was a blue button with that firm. And he worked his way up and he became a dealer. And... it was a really ruddy-faced bloke, quite small and very nice and a lot of fun. And he got married quite early in life and he landed up with quite a lot of children and a lot of responsibilities and so on. And I remember he went on holiday, this poor bloke, and he came back, and the day he came back, he walked in to his usual pitch and they weren't there. They'd actually gone bust, and they never told him. And it was quite extraordinary. And poor old Keith, literally, he didn't know. He came back to the Stock Exchange, and they said, well, they're bust, mate. They'd gone. Nobody told him.
What did he do?
Well, I mean, he went to find out what was going on, and I dare say it was all being wound up by the official receiver. And then he went off, strangely enough, and became a part of a member of the staff of the Union Discount, which actually happens to be our main shareholder. And he became their gilt dealer and did extremely well and is highly regarded in memory there because he died. But it was always a sort of classic, the guy who went on holiday never to return somehow, you know. And that was, and literally that finished his career in the Stock Exchange. But he did extremely well as a dealer and gilt dealer. But there was a change because he wasn't a gilt dealer of C.D. Clark. They dealt in industrials and they dealt in, you know, just generally industrials. But the other big firms, Bone Oldham, of course, was, when I said Werdelacker, it wasn't Werdelacker, it was Derlacker. And it was Bone Oldham. And they were one of the major mergers later on as firms got together. A little bit hard to recall all the names of those companies. I mean, I suppose one could sort of look back and find out who they were and you'd, you know, it'd all come back to you. But certainly Bone Oldham, certainly Smith Brothers, going back a long way, certainly Werdelacker. Kitchen Baker Mason was another very big firm which has gone, went quite early on. Moyne Shand was a reasonable sized firm. J.T.